This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, more than 6 million Americans are denied the right to vote because of a felony conviction. Black people are 5 times more likely than whites to be barred from the polls because of a criminal conviction. That's the result of a new and comprehensive study. We'll speak with Mark Maurer of the Sentencing Project.
But first, Hillary Clinton's supporters have been whipping up a hysteria, claiming that Donald Trump is such a dangerous fascist that progressives cannot afford to vote their consciences and support Jill Stein and Ajamu Baraka of the Green Party. But Black Agenda reports Glenn Ford told activists of the Georgia Peace and Justice Coalition in Atlanta last week that the world may not survive a Hillary Clinton in the White House. Ford said Clinton's proposed no-fly zone over Syria could lead almost immediately to a war between the United States and Russia, the world's two nuclear superpowers. And Glenn Ford said Donald Trump isn't the only candidate with fascist tendencies.
First of all, I think if we're going to throw this word fascism around, that we need to talk about what fascism really looks like in the 21st century and in the United States before we bandy this word about and use it to support Hillary Clinton. In my world, the fascists wear blue. And in my world, they work for Democratic mayors wearing blue, just like they work for Republican mayors. And in my world, fascists pass laws that deny people the right to due process, laws that permit the imprisonment without trial or even without a charge of people, which is the law that was passed by Barack Obama almost as soon as he got into the White House. In my world, fascism puts corporations above the law and turns the state into a vehicle for the interests of corporations, as in too big to jail. In my world, fascism draws on this ferocious, almost mythological hyper-nationalism that affords one's own country, I'm talking about the United States, a supreme mission in the world, a country with inherent powers that are above all of the rights and privileges of the other nations in the world. Now that sounds like American exceptionalism. And American exceptionalism is the ideology of Republicans and Democrats, the ideology of all recent and also not so recent U.S. presidents. That is the ideology that gives us so-called humanitarian military intervention, in which the United States decides which governments are going to survive and which will be overthrown, which heads of state are going to live and which are going to die. I think this is a fascist ideology, but it is shared by the presidents of both parties of the United States, and we take it as a given. That's why Hillary Clinton can cackle, "We came, we saw, he died," when she talks about Muammar Gaddafi. So I would prefer that we not throw around this word fascist. At any rate, again, Donald Trump's candidacy is doomed, but it's not doomed because he's a virulent racist. The Republicans have done just fine as the white man's party, as the Democrats did just fine when they were the white man's party. the fact is that the United States has always had a white man's party. Of the two dominant parties at any time in history, one of them has white supremacy as its guiding, energizing principle. So we've always had the Trumps. He only stands out today because these are more polite times, and he's not very polite. The reason that Donald Trump was a long shot from the very beginning is because his positions are against free trade, and free trade really means the free movement of money and jobs across borders, and because he has expressed opposition to regime change, sometimes incoherently, sometimes more coherently. But that is what he has expressed. He's expressed opposition to America's right to overthrow governments at will. Whether he was sincere about that or not, that is a taboo. You do not deny America her right to do what she wants in the world. And that is what chased much of the Republican establishment and especially much of their money away from Donald Trump and into Hillary Clinton's big tent. The money did not run away because he was a virulent racist. Most of the ruling class now, today, lives in Hillary Clinton's big campaign tent. It is bursting at the seams with money. Which brings us back to the subject of fascism. I would like to know how Donald Trump is supposed to build fascism when the ruling class is mostly with the Democrats this campaign season. If that's how fascism is going to be built, then it has no future in the United States, and you shouldn't be worried about it this election year. If you're only talking about fascism with orange hair and his face. I can't understand how people believe that you can become a fascist leader with the ruling corporate class aligned against you. History has never worked that way, and it's not going to work that way here. I think that if you are worried about 21st century fascism, and I am worried about 21st century fascism, you need to check out that big tent where the ruling class congregates, and that big tent is Hillary's tent. Most of all, if you are looking for fascists, then go to the beat of the war drum. That is where you will find the fascists dancing around and whooping and hollering and talking about who they're going to kill next. Where the war drums are beating, you will find the most serious brands of fascists. And you will find the real anti-fascists in the Peace Party. And in terms of national elections, this year, there is only one Peace Party, and that is the Green Party. Now, some folks might be disappointed, but I'm not going to spend a lot of time boosting the Green Party. But I'm going to say that it is the only anti-corporate party, the only anti-Wall Street party that is on the ballot in most states, although not here in Georgia. It's the only party with a serious principled position against mass black incarceration. And it is the only party that rejects American exceptionalism, that is, a license for the Americans to commit the worst crimes known to man, including genocide. And I will just mention the Democratic Republic of Congo, where 6 million people have died under both Democratic and Republican presidents since 1994. Now that Donald Trump is toast, there is no excuse for every person that considers themselves to be a leftist not to vote for Jill Stein and Ojamu Baraka, and Ojamu Baraka, by the way, when he's not running for vice president, is an editor of Black Agenda Report. There are not that many leftists out there anyway. And you won't throw the election to Donald Trump if you give a significant vote to the Green Party. And at least there would be the possibility of them getting federal funds the next time around. But there is not going to be necessarily a next time, because Hillary Clinton represents the greatest threat to life on Earth at this moment. And I mean that. I mean that from the bottom of my heart. She and President Obama have killed many hundreds of thousands of people just in Syria and Libya alone. But if a president, Hillary Clinton, if she goes through with her long-standing intention, said many times, to set up a no-fly zone in Syria, or if President Obama succumbs to the mounting pressures to do the same thing in Syria, war will almost certainly follow, and it will follow immediately. You're going to have to pray, if this no-fly zone comes into effect, that Vladimir Putin is not the kind of power-crazed maniac that they make him out to be. And you're going to have to pray that he backs down from this American aggression, because if he does not back down, then we will have arrived at the apocalypse. And it can happen at any moment. It could happen right now. We already may be living on borrowed time. And it's amazing that this corporate media isn't telling people that we are in the greatest danger since, I think a greater danger than during the Cuban Missile Crisis. The U.S. bombing raid that killed more than 80 Syrian soldiers prompted the Russians to announce, and I bet you didn't hear it on CNN, prompted the Russians to announce that they have put their Syrian air defense forces on orders to shoot down any aircraft that targets the Syrian units. And those aircraft could only be the aircraft of the United States. So we are on hair trigger right now, and no-fly zone has yet been announced. President Obama has reportedly told the Pentagon to cancel plans to bomb some certain Syrian units that have attacked the so-called moderate rebels. Of course, there is no such thing as moderate rebels in Syria, and really there never was. The brief ceasefire that you heard about, and then you all just as soon heard that it was over, it broke down because the United States finally said that it could not separate its so-called moderate proxies from Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is the former al-Nusra. It's changed its name. It's the same al-Qaeda front. And that al-Nusra front, rather, is by far the most powerful of the various groups that are arrayed against the Syrian government. It is their core military force. So we have come to the point where the United States is prepared to go to war with the other nuclear power in the world in defense of al-Qaeda. That is the situation in which we live. Clearly, Barack Obama does not want to go there. That's why he told his military folks to pull back. But Hillary Clinton does want to go there. And she repeated it again at last weekend's debate. And that is what makes her a danger to life on Earth. I don't think I'm using hyperbole here. That's why I'm saying, and I'm saying this in this week's Black Agenda report, that this election is not about who appoints a future U.S. Supreme Court. It is about whether we're going to have a future at all. The Supreme Court is not in danger. Hillary is going to win. There's no question about that. But there is a question of how much she will win by. She must not be given the kind of sweeping electoral mandate that encourages her to stay on the course of an armed confrontation with Russia. Most of us understand, certainly I think everybody in this room understands, that it will take a massive movement in the streets if we're going to turn around the U.S. war machine. That is a massive undertaking, and people have been at it for decades. But that kind of movement, building or rebuilding that kind of grassroots movement, takes time. And the crisis that we face is already upon us. And if a significant vote for the only peace party that is on most state ballots, one that can detract somewhat from Clinton's mandate, is not forthcoming, well, I don't know what's going to happen. As we agitate against war, we should be screaming at the top of our lungs the slogan, "No war for Al-Qaeda." I know we used to say no more war or no war for oil, but everybody knows that theme. This time around, it should be no war for Al-Qaeda. But you have to think about this. The United States is rolling the dice on the fate of humanity to stop the Syrians and the Russians from smashing the same damn terrorist army that is blamed for the attacks of 9/11. That is insane. How did we get to this kind of point? I think that if the American people fully digested that fact, that we are defending Al-Qaeda, the forces that led us into this nightmare would lose all legitimacy. They could not govern if folks really understood the nature of that war at this time. The revulsion among the people across the political spectrum would be too great. They couldn't govern. That's why successive presidents have erected an elaborate set of lies, lies that have been staring us in the face for more than three decades. It was the United States and Saudi Arabia that created the International Jihadist Network in Afghanistan back in the late 1970s. They created it to fight the leftist government, first just the leftist government in Afghanistan, and then to fight the Russians. What I just said is not conspiracy theory at all. It is fact for all to see. It is a fact that we all knew about as those facts unfolded. President Carter's National Security Advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, played a big role in the creation of this international jihadist network. And he has been bragging about it ever since. These are not conspiracy theories. The CIA and the Saudis spent billions of dollars pulling in jihadists from all over the world, pulling them into Afghanistan. And that included, of course, Osama bin Laden. The CIA has been bragging about this all these years as well. And they've made movies about this. So this is common knowledge. It's not conspiracy theory, but people do not seem to put these facts that are known to all together. There have always been Islamic jihadists. There have been Islamic jihadists as long as there have been Muslims, just as there have been crusaders and such. But in modern times, there has not been an international jihadist network. The CIA and the Saudi Arabians changed all that less than four decades ago. The CIA found, after they put these networks together caused great grief and the withdrawal of the Russians from Afghanistan, they found them useful, and they maintained their ties to these organizations that they didn't birth jihadism, but they birthed that network, and they kept their ties with those groups. There's a reason that the United States has played with this jihadist fire all these years. The reason is because there aren't any mass groupings of people in that part of the Muslim world that the U.S. can mobilize when it decides that it wants to topple a government, except these jihadists. The United States and Western Europe are hated in that part of the world. They're hated for righteous reasons. They're hated for their history of colonialism, and they're hated for their alliance with Israel. So, to overcome that fact, to overcome the fact that most people do not want to collaborate with the United States in that part of the world because of its policies, because in another language, there is no social base in these countries for collaboration with the United States. The U.S. teamed up with the Saudis to mobilize and arm the most backward and reactionary elements of these Muslim societies. In Afghanistan, that was the local warlords and the local landowners who were allied with the local warlords. And it was those folks who were resisting the liberation of women in Afghanistan, which was a cause and primary aim of that leftist government that came to power in the late 1970s, and that Zbigniew Brzezinski and President Carter wanted to get rid of. And of course, they forged a relationship with the more reactionary elements of the Muslim clergy. And when this strategy worked against the Soviets in Afghanistan, it became the model that the CIA and the Saudis used throughout the Muslim world. The U.S. and Saudi Arabia used those jihadists to undermine secular governments throughout the Arab world. That was the only strong card that the United States had to play. The U.S. tried direct intervention using its huge land-based military. It tried that in Lebanon in the 1980s under Ronald Reagan. And many of you will remember what happened with that. It did not go well. 200 Marines were blown up and the United States withdrew from Lebanon. The first George Bush put U.S. boots on the ground in Iraq, and that was in the first Gulf War. But Bush Sr. Didn't want the United States to become an occupying power in that part of the world. He knew the dangers, and he knew that the people would resist that kind of occupation from a European or American power. So what Bush did after smashing Saddam's army in the first Gulf War was stand out from a distance and strangle Iraq and bomb it, but from a distance, without occupying it. He did that for another decade or so. But George Bush Jr. invaded Iraq with full force, despite the fact that most of America's allies warned that he shouldn't do that. George Bush was aiming to permanently occupy Iraq and to treat it basically as a colony. That project ended in defeat and humiliation for the United States. And that was really a real military crisis for U.S. imperialism, because the U.S., after that debacle, no longer had the option to use its vast land-based military as a stick in that part of the world. So here the United States is, the undisputed superpower in the world, with hundreds of thousands of men in arms, but it can't use them in that part of the world. And that's very frustrating for an imperialist. The other reason they couldn't use it, in addition to the fact that Iraq showed that people would resist, is that the American people would not stand for that kind of use of the American military. And that is why and how we wound up with Barack Obama in the White House. And we wound up with him in the White House with the backing of key elements of the ruling class. They thought this would be a good idea in the wake of the U.S. defeat and humiliation in Iraq. His job was to put a new face on U.S. imperialism. It was a charming face, a handsome face, an intelligent face, a face that could repair the American image in the world and also the American self-image. The problem was that U.S. imperialism had not changed, despite the fact that it had a much more attractive face. The U.S. still needed to project power on the ground if it was going to be the imperial power that dominates the world. And even though the U.S. was now using the war on terror as an excuse for carrying out lawless acts all over the world, and an excuse for curtailing civil liberties here at home, the United States still needed those same standby folks. They still needed these jihadists from the international network that they created in order to further its policies in the Middle East. You can see the huge contradiction here. The United States can't use its own troops. The indigenous populations would not tolerate that, and the American public would not. And so how is it going to influence events? The United States still had a list of countries that it was going to overthrow, and that included Syria, and it included Libya, and other countries. How is it going to do that if it can't transport its divisions of soldiers? What's it going to do? Well, they had to go back to the model. They had to go back to the jihadists. The Iraq war had not changed their dependency on these jihadists. The crisis came about in 2011, when there was a revolutionary fervor in Egypt. Now, there was also an upheaval in Tunisia, but Egypt was the main theater. Egypt is where these history-making changes were coming about, because when Mubarak, who'd been a U.S. client for a very long time, when Mubarak was overthrown, that scared the hell out of the Saudi Arabians and the United Arab Emirates and the Qataris and all of these royal kleptomaniacs in the Persian Gulf. These people do not have competent armies because these are oil-producing countries. And not only do many of its citizens not really work for a living, they import folks from South Asia and elsewhere, and the Philippines and all around the world to do the dirty work in those countries. but they don't have competent armies. And many of their armies are basically made up of mercenaries. And what was important about Mubarak in Egypt is that Egypt has a huge standing army. And there was an understanding between the Saudis and Mubarak that if there were any crisis and these oil-rich regimes were threatened, then Mubarak and his many, many hundred thousands strong army would come to the rescue. So when Mubarak was overthrown and the United States didn't know what to do and looked very indecisive, I know many of you remember those weeks when Tahrir Square was on televisions all over the place, and you couldn't get a coherent word out of the State Department or the White House, because the United States didn't know what to do. The Saudis were freaking out. They were having an existential threat moment. They felt naked and exposed, and they demanded that the United States take charge in that region. They were in a panic in January and February of 2011, and when the Saudis go into a panic, then the Europeans go into a panic. And the French were already going into a panic over Muammar Gaddafi's plans to use many, many tons of Libyan gold the huge oil revenues that Libya collected each year to create an African Development Bank and to create, through that bank, an African currency, a currency that would have weakened France's stranglehold over its former colonies in Africa. And that was a crisis for France. So, after much indecision, the United States seized control of the situation, or attempted to, by putting itself on the side of what it coined as the Arab Spring. And that's when it said its jihadist dogs loose on Gaddafi. It put into effect the rather new doctrine of responsibility to protect, R2P, which is another word for humanitarian military intervention. And after crushing Gaddafi, they moved that whole show, lock, stock, and barrel, to Syria. The International Jihadist Network was now indispensable in the Middle East to the United States. The Syrian government was supposed to fall rather quickly, in a year or two. It took about, 7 or 8 months for Libya to fall. They anticipated that the Assad government would last no more than 2 years. And all of the WikiLeaks cables and just regular reporting by newspapers shows that anticipation was there. But this government really did have strong, broad support, especially among the minority groups in Syria. And that included the Kurds. It certainly included the Christians. But it went beyond the Alawite slash Shiite folks. It included people who were doing well under a secular regime. So it was untrue that Assad's government didn't have support. And that was proven by the fact that they did not fall, even though the government army was taking huge casualties. But the United States and the French and the Turks and, of course, the Saudi Arabians and others kept on pouring more and more money, more and more weapons, and gathering more and more jihadists from all over the world. It kept doubling down, even as the Assad government kept surviving. And it was inevitable that the jihadists would at some point start fighting the war that they wanted to fight in all of its sectarian horrors, because they were not really fighting for the United States, and they weren't fighting for the French, and they weren't fighting for the Turks, and they weren't fighting for the Saudi Arabians. as far as they were concerned, they were fighting for God. By August of 2012, analysts at the Defense Intelligence Agency, that's a part of the U.S. military, the DIA, they put out a memo, which was only uncovered because of a civil suit years later, but they put out a memo that said the conditions had been created in Syria for the jihadists to set up their own caliphate in parts of Iraq and parts of Syria. And what's more, this DIA memo said that it looked like, and they're speaking as intelligence analysts themselves, that it looked like the U.S. and its allies wanted that to happen. Now, that memo presumably finally made its way to the desk of President Obama. We don't know for sure, but I think we can presume it did. By the next year, by 2013, ISIS had its coming out party, just as the DIA memo basically predicted. Later that year, we see President Obama backing off, and it seemed like at the last minute, from launching an all-out attack on the Syrian government after a chemical weapons attack that the U.S. blamed on the Assad government. The corporate media explained why President Obama, at the last moment, called off this massive air attack by saying, well, it was because of anti-war sentiment in Congress, or because the British Parliament wasn't going to go along, or because the French Parliament was thinking that it might object too. I do not believe that for a second. The United States government does not roll like that. It doesn't care about what other countries think. And there was not that kind of effective anti-war sentiment in the U.S. Congress. Obama did not attack Syria. He backed down, he blinked, because he had to consider that if he inflicted such huge damage on the Syrian army, then ISIS and Al-Qaeda, which were by far the strongest forces among the so-called rebels, and the other rebels were also jihadists, that ISIS and Al-Qaeda would just walk into Damascus. And if they walked into Damascus, Obama had to contemplate, how the hell am I going to get them out of Damascus, since we're the ones who put them in the field, and we're the ones who gave them the money, and we're the ones who gave them the weapons, and there's nobody there. If the Syrian army is destroyed, nobody there to stop them. And so Obama blinked. That is the same problem that Obama has now. Now that the Russians have helped the Syrian army to push back the jihadists, and they now have Al-Qaeda, that's that al-Nusra outfit, bottled up in a small corner of Aleppo. Now you hear not just Hillary Clinton and most of the other politicians, Republican as well as Democrat, and CNN and the New York Times, they're all talking about the siege of Aleppo. Aleppo, which was Syria's biggest city, has about 1.5 million people in it. The neighborhoods in East Aleppo that are occupied and have been occupied by al-Nusra for the last 3 years contains 200, maybe 250,000 people. It is from those neighborhoods that the 1.2 or so million other Syrians living in government-controlled Aleppo have been shelled for the last 3 years. And the larger Aleppo was at times encircled and under siege. But the only siege that is going on right now is that small part of Aleppo that is controlled by Al-Qaeda. This is where the United States is saying that it cannot separate its moderate rebels from Al-Qaeda, and that this is a travesty, and this may require the United States to attack the Syrian army and thereby attack the Russians, who not only man the anti-aircraft defenses, who not only fly the most effective aircraft in the skies, but there is a brigade of Russian Marines right outside Aleppo. So this is a war situation, and all to make sure that Al-Qaeda is not crushed in its little corner of that city.
That was Glenn Ford speaking to the Georgia Peace and Justice Coalition in Atlanta. The United States claims it is the premier democracy on the planet, but this country has the lowest voter turnout in the industrialized world. Part of the reason is the U.S. practice of denying the vote to people with felony records. A new study by the Sentencing Project in Washington shows that 6 million Americans have been disenfranchised because of criminal records. According to the Sentencing Project Executive Director Mark Maurer, only the United States treats ex-felons like non-citizens.
No, there's nothing we know of that comes even close to this. We have the best data on other industrialized democratic nations. And in those countries, to the extent that they practice disenfranchisement, it's limited to people only in prison. At the same time, many industrialized nations don't disenfranchise at all, so people in prison can vote as well. In the United States, virtually every state disenfranchised people in prison, but substantial numbers also for people living in the community under probation or parole supervision, and 12 states can disenfranchise people even after they've completed their sentence. For example, an 18-year-old is convicted of a first-time felony drug possession, sentenced to go to a treatment program, which they complete successfully, and yet, if they live in Florida or Virginia or Kentucky, they're disenfranchised for the rest of their life.
And of course, what distinguishes the U.S. from the rest of the industrialized world is its history of domestic slavery.
Well, it's not called that, of course, but, you know, we can certainly trace a centuries-long history of disenfranchisement and racism in society and in the criminal justice system. You know, these laws go back to the time of the founding of the country, and this experiment democracy was an experiment, but a very limited one, of course. So a group of wealthy white male property holders granted themselves the right to vote, but excluded women, African Americans, poor people, illiterates, and also people with felony convictions. There was a period of time in the post-Reconstruction era in the South, the same time as poll taxes and literacy requirements were being adopted, that some of the Southern states tinkered with their disenfranchisement law with the specific intent of addressing black male voters. So you had in states like Alabama, South Carolina, they made it so that if you convicted of beating your wife, you would lose your right to vote. If you convicted of killing your wife, you would not lose the right to vote. And that was all based on the racial logic of the time. So very strange ways in this and how this comes about.
There's a startling figure in your report. You show that there are four states, Florida, Tennessee, Kentucky, and Virginia, in which between one and four and one out of every five African Americans is disenfranchised for felony convictions.
Yeah, it's quite remarkable. And, you know, what we see is that first, these are states generally with a high rate of incarceration, and as is true in every state, the rate of incarceration of African Americans generally dwarfs that of whites, usually by about a 5-to-1 ratio. So the combined effect of this high rate of incarceration and the fact that in these states many, if not most, of the people who've completed their sentence are still disenfranchised means that it's a lifetime ban, and so those numbers become quite dramatic. You know, a 30-year-old who gets out of prison for the first time may never reoffend, but is going to be disenfranchised until he or she dies the age of 70 or 80, let's say. The only way you can get your rights restored is essentially by a pardon from the governor, and in most states, that's not an easy process to be successful with.
Yes, and we note that these four worst states are all part of the old Confederacy, as are many of the states with the highest rates of felony disenfranchisement.
Well, exactly. And, you know, we've seen a very sordid history of race and criminal justice in the southern states for well over a century. After the Civil War, we saw the development of the convict leasing system, whereby African Americans were often picked up for very minor offenses, loitering and the like. And they were then incarcerated and leased out their labor from the prison system to local plantations in many cases. So the sort of bizarre irony there is that people who had once been enslaved not too many years before, in some cases, were now working on the very same plantations they'd been enslaved at, only in this case it was through a convict leasing system. So, you know, one author has titled his book Slavery by Another Name. You know, it's eerily similar how some of this has developed.
Here's another astounding finding from your study. You say that the state of Florida alone accounts for more than one out of every four persons in the whole country that's been prevented from voting because of a felony. 27% of all of these disenfranchisements. And Florida is the quintessential swing state in national presidential elections.
Well, absolutely. And people sometimes ask, well, you know, do these policies affect real electoral outcomes? All we need to do is go back to the election of the year 2000, where we recall George Bush beat Al Gore by a total of 537 votes in the state of Florida that turned the national election. On the day of that election, there were an estimated 800,000 ex-felons, people who'd completed their sentence yet were not permitted to vote. And, you know, had Florida not had such extreme policies, you know, we can only speculate about how many of those people would have voted and who they would have voted for. But clearly, we may have decided a national election based on this policy in this very significant state of Florida, as you point out.
Could you give us a rundown of the good, the bad, and the ugly in terms of how the various states are dealing with massive disenfranchisement?
Well, I mean, in some ways, there's a good bit of good news. Over the last 15 years, you know, a good number of states have actually revisited these laws and enacted policies to scale back the categories of disenfranchisement. So just in this year alone, first, the Maryland legislature moved to remove the ban on people voting while they're on probation or parole supervision. That's estimated to reenfranchise about 40,000 people. In California, just last week, Governor Brown signed into law a measure whereby anyone convicted of a felony but held in a local jail rather than a state prison will now be able to vote. That may be some 50,000 people. And in Virginia, Governor Terry McAuliffe earlier this year tried to reenfranchise an entire group of 200,000 ex-felons who had completed their sentence. He was challenged in court. The state Supreme Court ruled that he couldn't do that en masse, had to do it individually, and so now he's going through that process, already has done the paperwork for 13,000 people to get their rights restored, and he's vowed to get to that whole group of 200,000. So it's encouraging developments in this reconsideration, but unfortunately it's balanced against the states like Florida, where those numbers keep rising every year, and it just points to the significance of addressing the problems in some of those deep southern states, which has such high rates of disenfranchisement.
In recent decades, we've seen an increase in the number of conservative Republican lawmakers that have supported various notions of criminal justice reform. But has that carried over to the felon disenfranchisement issue?
Well, it has to some. In Congress, the most significant development there has been that Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky has joined with Senator Cory Booker from New Jersey in a bipartisan movement. They've introduced legislation that would re-enfranchise individuals in federal elections, even if their own state doesn't permit them to vote in state elections. And Senator Paul has been quite outspoken about this, quite articulate about the issue, and so it's been encouraging to see that kind of leadership. We don't see that as much around the country, although in some cases Republican governors have signed into law measures approved by their legislature. Back in 1997 in Texas, the legislature removed a two-year ban on voting 2 years after a person got out of prison, did away with that, and that was signed into law by then-Governor George W. Bush. So, you know, my hope is that this does not become a partisan political issue. We should be debating this issue on questions of democracy and citizenship and not pretend that we know how this group of people would vote or care how they would vote. Either it's right or wrong to keep them disenfranchised, and I think we should address the problem on that basis.
Have you been satisfied with the weight that the Obama White House has given to this issue?
Well, certainly, when Eric Holder was in office as Attorney General, on one occasion he delivered a major speech at Georgetown University solely on this issue of disenfranchisement. It was very encouraging to see this. We've heard some words of support from the White House. One of the problems here is that, by and large, this is a state-based issue. You know, every state has the authority to develop its own voting procedures, and so most of the battle is at that level. The one in exception to that, as I mentioned, is possible federal legislation that would apply to voting in federal elections, and that legislation has been introduced in a number of sessions of Congress, has not gone too far in recent years, but we're hoping to call renewed attention to it and see how much support that we can get on a bipartisan basis.
Well, then the question becomes, has the Democratic leadership in Congress been giving sufficient attention to felon voting rights?
Well, there's been support, and we've seen it from both parties. It hasn't risen to the level of a major priority yet. And to be fair, you know, criminal justice reform broadly has been gaining significant attention in recent years. The issue of felony disenfranchisement has not been in the top tier of issues that they're looking at generally.
The rest of the world looks at the United States, which claims to be this vaunted citadel of democracy, and yet they see that a huge proportion of the American population can't even vote.
Yes, very much so, very much so. And, you know, our policies are, just as our incarceration policies are extreme by world standards, so are our disenfranchisement policies. You know, other democratic nations may prohibit people in prison from voting, but limit it to that, and many nations don't have any prohibition, so even people in prison can vote, and it would be unthinkable in other democratic nations to disenfranchise people permanently for life based on a felony conviction.
Isn't this U.S. practice of massive voter disenfranchisement an affront to the very notion of democracy?
Well, it certainly is. And, you know, in fact, the issue has been raised in some international tribunals. Several years ago, the European Court of Human Rights examined the case in the United Kingdom, which disenfranchised people while they were serving a prison sentence. And they ruled that that was a violation of human rights, that people could be prohibited on a case-by-case basis and perhaps by the crime they committed, but that a blanket prohibition violated human rights standards. So it has received that kind of attention internationally.
Yes, that was a case against Britain, but has there been any specific legal brief brought against the United States in any international court of law?
No, we haven't seen that. It's come up in some United Nations reviews, you know, periodic reviews around civil and political rights and other issues and racism in policy, and many non-governmental organizations like the Sensing Project and others have raise this issue, and it's been reported on in some of those UN reports as recommendations to the United States government. You know, it's difficult to say how much reaction there will be or has been, you know, to those reports, but it's been a sort of steady drumbeat of attention in the international arena trying to call attention to this just extreme policy that we have.
Do you think that U.S. voting practices rise to the level of a crime against human rights?
You know, I'm not an attorney. It's hard for me to know that. You know, there have been a number of legal challenges within the United States courts. Most of them to date have not been successful, and it's been an uphill battle in many cases when issues of racial disparity have been raised. The rejoinder that comes back is, well, African Americans or other groups are more likely to be involved in crime and therefore more likely to be disenfranchised, and that's just the way it is. And we would counter, of course, that there's a racist history of these disenfranchisement laws and their adoption in many states, and further that the criminal justice system does not play fair across the board. There's a well-documented history of racial disparities and how people are treated and what kinds of policing, prosecution, and sentencing people of color are subject to. And those issues have been raised in some of the cases, but as I've said, not successful to date.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.